From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome back to The Advice Show. I'm Julian Bovell, and this week I'm joined by Jamie Jenkins, Director of Policy at Royal London. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining me.
How morning. Are you? Morning, Julian. You're very well, thank you.
Yeah, long journey for you down from Scotland this morning. Thanks for coming in. It's been a busy few months for financial services and pension policy. It all seemed to get backloaded onto the start of everyone's summer. What's your general assessment of the landscape as we are in September?
Yeah, interesting times, Julian, on pensions particularly. We have had the pension schemes bill, which is fast making its way through process within Parliament, with little in the way of significant change, really. But also the announcement of another pensions commission, which is interesting. And the way I look at those two things is you've got the pension schemes bill is largely a function of a collection of different initiatives being brought together under a plan over the next 5 years. A lot of them around the elements of scaling up and having fewer larger providers in the market. Yeah. Whereas the Pensions Commission, interestingly, really looks beyond that and starts to beg the question of what's the deal for our children or our grandchildren when they retire? What should they expect from the state? What do they expect employers to pay in along the way? And what's the onus on them to save for their retirement? So really interesting stuff.
And I suppose the government indicated that split through separating the pensions review into stage one and stage two. Stage one we've already had, which was sort of about investment. How do those two things interact?
Yeah, very much linked. I mean, stage one was about investment. In practice, though, the bill contains a whole range of measures, which include consolidation, value for money, and the gathering up of small pots and how we deal with that, the further elements of the dashboard and the interplay with those. So there's various things in that. They do have a central theme, though, I would say, of investment. And the scale agenda is around the ability for larger pension schemes to invest more significantly in private markets in the UK. So, yeah, that was the first element. I think the second element seeks to probably play more heavily into the questions for consumers, for savers, and exactly how do we ensure that they get good outcomes, or at least fair outcomes in terms of what they can expect from the different parties.
Mm. I mean, so in the announcement of the Pensions Commission, some of the words that I can pick out here, complex barriers to people saving enough. What are some of those complex barriers, do you think, that the government hope the commission will identify?
Yeah, there are. So, I mean, it's interesting because automatic enrolment has clearly moved the dial significantly in terms of getting eligible employees saving into a pension. And the numbers there are very high. You might argue they're optimum. You know, most people who are working who are eligible for an auto-enrollment workplace pension have been auto-enrolled, and most of them stay in the scheme. But it does point to some of the bigger gaps that exist in the landscape. So there are significant gaps with people that have multiple jobs but don't meet the £10,000 threshold in any of those jobs. There are people who are simply on lower paid part-time roles who perhaps don't get picked up by the auto-enrollment system.
Yeah.
And of course, the self-employed significantly seem to be sort of in decline as far as pension saving is concerned, compared with, you know, the employed equivalents.
Yeah. And I mean, last year during the budget, we saw the government change or sort of put some taxes up around NI. How has that interacted with the government's hope of getting more people saving into their pension, or perhaps even lowering the AE rate?
Yeah, not directly, but certainly indirectly. I mean, it's one of those things where I think a lot has been pinned on the increase in national insurance, whether that's companies confidence in investing or growing or expanding or recruiting. I mean, all sorts of.
I suppose their costs have gone up, right?
Well, indeed. So their costs have gone up. I mean, I think what we possibly have seen in the aftermath of that, because of the increased costs, I think probably fewer employers are sort of keen to review or move pension schemes, and with perhaps the enthusiasm they might have been otherwise, because there is that increased cost. But, you know, having said all that, salary sacrifice provides a really important way of mitigating some of the cost of the increased national insurance.
You mentioned earlier about private markets. That is something that the government are obviously pinning quite a lot of hopes on. Torsten Bell is on the record as saying that UK allocation simply isn't high enough. I mean, do those opportunities exist, and what can the government do to ensure that firms are getting those opportunities?
It's a really big subject, and to be honest, private markets as a sort of overarching term masks quite a diversity of different things that you can invest in. For our part, we have quite significant exposure within our Royal London funds to property, which is held directly, so it is certainly under the definition of private markets. But beyond that, there is credit, there is equity, there is infrastructure, and there's all sorts of things in there that really behave in quite different ways. And so, you know, different providers are looking at different elements of that to include. I think you're right, though. There is a challenge in scaling up not just the demand side for private markets investment in the UK, which is arguably there through some of the voluntary agreements we now have, such as the Mansion House Accord and Compact, but then the supply side, and making sure that sort of supply of suitable private market investments is coming through for pension schemes to invest in. At the end of the day, this is members' money we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's for their retirement. So it must work for them first and foremost, rather than necessarily just work for the economic growth agenda.
Do you think there's a danger that the government lose sight of that fact, that it is the members' money and not the... or successive governments, perhaps?
There is. I mean, the desire for growth, the need for growth is so great now that there is a concern there. And I think where that's played out most recently is the provision within the pension schemes bill to mandate certain levels of investment. And I think there's been a lot of pushback on that. For my part, I don't really see it being invoked. I don't see the circumstances politically where any government could seek to tell people how their pensions money should be invested.
Why is that? Why do you take that view? I mean, they've been quite bullish even since announcing it, that this is something they could do.
They have, but they've positioned it really as a backstop. So if they don't see money coming into private markets and into the UK, then they reserve the right to do something about that. I don't really see that transpiring. I see that there will be more investment in the UK in private markets over time, certainly over the time frame over the next 5 years that we are talking about. But moreover, I think it'd be very difficult for the government, any government, as I say, any future government for that matter, to tell people this is how we are going to mandate that you invest your hard-earned pension savings.
Yeah.
I think that's really tricky, and I think the pushback would be so great. And we've seen in recent times, this government and previous governments had, you know, having to reverse policies they've sought to put in place because the backlash has been so strong.
Yeah, it seems to have been a decade of U-turns, or at least the last 5 years. We spoke at the time, I recall, about the sunset clause that was in there. I mean, that's an interesting element until 2035. So potentially it might not be a Labour government that's in power when that expires.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we've yet to see where that lands. There are many suggestions that it should be brought forward to 2030. Some have said 2031, 32. You know, I'm not sure whether that feels arbitrary, but it is quite important because, as you say, it certainly pushes into the next parliamentary term and potentially, therefore, another government to pick up that mantle. So 2035, I think most people would say, feels like quite a long way away in parliamentary terms, in political terms, and actually bringing it forward might be sensible. We've yet to see whether the government chooses to do that as the bill passes through. But it is an important point. Yeah, it feels like the sunset clause shouldn't be so far away that it becomes quite unpredictable as to where we'll be.
Damoclean sword, perhaps, hanging over the companies. Another sort of major part of the government and I suppose the FCA's policy moving forward was the value for money framework, sort of reformed version we saw. I think I've got a quote from you here saying the challenge with the proposed value for money framework is that it looked divergent from a pension system as gearing towards longer term investment opportunities. That was about sort of the previous iteration when they had the traffic lights. How do you see that working with the government's growth agenda moving forward?
Yeah, so still a few things to be ironed out on the value for money framework. I mean, at a very basic level, it is seeking rightly to ensure that the bigger and fewer providers who remain in the market after 2030.
The 25 billion.
Yeah, but by virtue of the minimum threshold of 25 billion. So those providers are, you know, they become more systemically important, if you like, in people's lives as to how they save for their retirement. So it's right that we should ensure that they are all offering value and seek to take steps where that is not the case. And the basic metrics are around the returns they get from their investments, the charges and the service they receive. There are some other elements, but those are the main elements. I think the missing bit for me is something that does look longer term. So, for example, if we are encouraging, or indeed the government were mandating, to invest in private markets where the return profile can be quite different, quite often longer term, quite
that
often
needs
expensive.
To be made clear to clients, right?
And that needs to be made clear, but it also needs to fit within a framework that isn't just looking at the very immediate returns, because that seems to work against the government's agenda for investing in those sorts
of
assets.
Fear of the herding thing that everybody was talking
about. There's then a fear of herding, which some people say, well, you know, why is that a problem? You know, if we all invest in things that, you know, broadly return the same thing. But it kind of does stifle innovation. As I say, it doesn't seem to ride comfortably alongside the government's growth agenda. I think there is something else in this, Julian, around, you know, let's not lose sight of the net zero agenda in all of this. So we have a sustainability ambition with our investments in pensions, which, although it doesn't get talked about much right now in political terms, is still there. And that's not measured within the value for money framework. So to my mind, that is a missing component too. And something
it's also
we need to bring in
of where employees want their money invested, right?
Yeah, well, indeed. Well, I mean, what is the provider's commitment to sustainability, to net zero, responsible investment, you know, all of those issues. And it's not to say that should be the prevailing factor for everybody, but let's not forget that it's there, because if we don't measure it, then there is a concern that it starts to fade from priority.
Do you fear that that could be the case if the government and sort of FCA so
true? I do fear that if it's a very sort of short-term outlook, and there's this separate drive for economic growth. You know, economic growth shouldn't be exclusive of net zero. You know, it should be that sustainable investments of the future are also kind of powering economic growth. And we need to bring those things together rather than drive them apart.
UK perhaps pursuing its own path on that, divergent from something going on in the United States, perhaps.
Well, indeed. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of political, geopolitical and international kind of pressure around these points. And there's a lot of disagreement between different nations on exactly how to proceed. And there's a lot of short-term pressures that are driving different behaviours. But I don't think the climate has paused to allow us to work through those challenges. I think the climate will continue to change as we would expect. So we need to keep that one in mind.
We discussed also in reaction to the Pensions Commission around the government allowing defined benefit schemes to release surplus. You had some quite strong thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is an existing option for a number of defined benefit schemes and their trustees and sponsors. So it's not a new thing. The bit that's new is it's really extending that option to all schemes, effectively kind of overriding.
Lowered the amount, right?
Well, also lowering the threshold, yeah. So the kind of threshold test to one of low dependency, I think it's been described as, such that surplus can be released without necessarily reaching buyout levels.
Yeah.
There are some concerns around that. I mean, to my mind, I doubt that many smaller defined benefit schemes will significantly change course. I think many of them would actually find that the exercise of going through how to release surplus and satisfy all the tests and then release a small amount of money might, and then keep the ongoing risk of the scheme, of course, and its costs of maintenance may well outweigh any benefit of releasing surplus. So I think it is largely the preserve of bigger schemes, that many of which would have had these options anyway. The big question mark in all of it, though, is if the intention is for surplus to be released to then be spent driving economic growth, whatever that may be, hiring people, buying plant machinery, opening new offices, whatever that may be, there's no mandation for that to be how the money is used. And it could be that the money is simply used and paid to shareholders, yeah, which is not in itself a bad thing, but it's probably not driving economic growth.
And then that carries the risk that money then needs to be used again to pay out the members.
Well, indeed. I mean, at some point, you know, some employers may well regret that going forward if they've significantly cut into their surplus.
There'd be dragons, perhaps. We've obviously got the budget coming up at the end of November, November 26th, I think it's penciled in for. What's your assessment of the landscape before that, the rumours and whatever else have started in earnest?
Well, I mean, at a broad economic level, it's quite clear that the Chancellor is going to face another challenge in terms of spending more than we earn day to day running the country. That's very clear. The economists can debate exactly what those numbers look like, yeah, but it certainly looks, you know, potentially equal.
She said last year that she wouldn't, Rich Roux said that she wouldn't have to do such a budget again. Is it looking like?
Well, I mean, I think most economists would say, well, you know, had we started to see significant economic growth and the sort of the gradual increase in tax income that generates as salaries move up and more people are employed and so on and so forth, then, you know, we might not have been in this position, but we are where we are. And it looks like we are facing something equal to or greater than the deficit in those finances that the Chancellor faced last year. So the backdrop is difficult. I think there's no doubt about that. And
the OBR for the OBR said that the economy shrunk in the last 2 months, right?
So. Well, indeed. So let's acknowledge that to some measure, whatever that number turns out to be, there is another deficit that needs to be addressed. Now, I'm not going to sit here and suggest I have the magic bullet for how the Chancellor is going to.
If we did, neither of us would be here.
Well, indeed. But I do imagine the way I look at it, Julian, if you'll indulge me for a second, I imagine that there is a room somewhere. This may or may not be the case, right? But I imagine there is a room somewhere with oak paneling all round. You know, maybe it's in number 11 Downing Street.
And roaring fire and a nice
Well, there's a very big pile of flip chart paper and post-it notes on the oak table in the middle. And there will be a small select group of people who will be working through those and putting the various kind of subject headers on the wall on a flip chart and then adding post-it notes to that. One of those will be pensions, so there'll be a flip chart for pensions, I dare say, in my imaginary room. And then somebody will have put things like, you know, the annual allowance, the lifetime allowance, or its reintroduction. They'll have put tax-free cash as a post-it note. And all these post-it notes will be on that flip chart, probably with the heading pensions cost £50 billion net, or something of that order. So it's a big number. It's always going to be a
triple
flip
lock
chart on the wall. What's that?
Triple lock.
Triple lock. Well, triple lock seems untouchable based on the promises that have been made. But I mean, I've made it very clear. I don't think it's necessarily budget territory, but it certainly should be in the scope of the Pensions Commission, because it is essentially ratcheting up the state pension, as we're seeing again this year, at the highest of three measures every year.
2.5% interest has gone up this year.
Yeah, so you know, that can't continue forever. As I've said a couple of times in recent events, I mean, my 7-year-old son, Arlo, I could realistically say to him, look, if the triple lock continues in the state pension forever, you needn't bother saving, because you'll end up with an enormous state pension by the time you come to retire.
Yeah.
Now, clearly that's not tenable nor realistic, and I'm not saying that to him, to be clear.
Be a bad mentality.
Bad father.
Still in your
shop. But it illustrates the point. The triple lock is not tenable over the very long term. So we should instead think about, well, what are we trying to achieve with it? What level do we want to get the state pension to, which we think is fair as the deal from the state for people who need it in retirement?
Do you think he could be bold and do sort of what Australia did, and they sort of uprate it?
Well, I mean, the age pension, as I think they call it in Australia, the equivalent of the state pension is fully means tested,
yeah,
which is quite different. And I'm not suggesting we're at that point yet, but I think Australia's sort of got to that point through much higher levels of
long-term assessment and view of the pension landscape, isn't it? I mean, they started the journey they're on in the mid-90s, not you're saying?
Well, indeed. And, you know, they're approaching 12% mandatory contributions for everyone. Yeah. So, you know, it gives you different choices when you get to that level of maturity of saving. But, you know, I'm not suggesting we go there now, but we should start laying down a plan for the state pension and thinking about what we want it to achieve. And the Pensions Commission seems like an ideal opportunity to do that, to take it at least initially out of the gaze of politics and politicians and promises that need to be made, all of which I understand, but take it out of that and then look at it objectively.
Mm. Because much like the NHS, I suppose, right or wrong, it's become political football, hasn't it, that politicians dare not kick. It's sort of, you mentioned that at pensions in the budget, there was quite major changes to the pension landscape. I mean, are there things on the table then that you think they could revisit? You mentioned the lifetime allowance there, reintroducing that.
Yeah, I'm not going to sit here and predict what the Chancellor will do, and I suspect none of those decisions have yet been made. So it's not about sort of any kind of intelligence on this. I suspect they're still being worked through. The way I look at it, though, is if you go back to this room that I've created with the oak panelling and the flip charts on the wall, and you pull down, for example, what's being talked about widely at the moment is changes to tax-free cash. If you pull down that post-it note and had the discussion, I think it would go probably along the lines of, well, how popular or unpopular would be if we reduced tax-free cash, and who would be most upset by that change? And I think you'd conclude quite quickly that quite a large number of people would be quite upset, including some who, you know, may go on strike as a result of it, as you've seen in the past. I think they would then ask, well, how complex is it to do? You know, to what extent do we need to engage government departments in overseeing it? And I think if you assume that there was some form of protection in place and it wasn't a cliff edge of changes for people who are perhaps, you know, about to pay off their mortgage the next month or the next year, some form of protections or phasing involved, that gets quite complicated quite quickly.
Mm.
And then thirdly, how much does it raise? You know, what do we actually get back? And if you assume there are some protections and that behavioural responses change quite significantly, people don't just cash in a huge amount as they would have done and pay a huge amount of tax. They'll do something different.
Yeah.
So all of those things together, I would probably put that post-it note back and put a big red cross through it.
Yeah.
Because to me, it doesn't stack up. There may be other things that do on pensions, but that one, it doesn't seem obvious, certainly on my tests.
I'm sure they'll have a behavioural economist in that room. I mean, some of the numbers that they might look at, the FCA released its latest tranche of retirement income data last week, 35.9% increase in pension withdrawals over the past year amid sort of increasing speculation over major changes. I mean, that sort of says it all about what you were just saying.
Yeah, there's an element of that. I mean, there's a couple of things to say. I mean, the statistics take us up to, I think, March of this year, March 2025. So they don't clearly encompass anything that's happened in very recent months.
But major increases between October and March.
That's right. Yeah. So it reflects probably the experience that we saw last year, where many people actually sought to take out tax-free cash, for example, based on speculation ahead of last year's budget. And then nothing changed. And then many people sought to put their money back in, which proved very problematic. And I don't think that's going to be allowed this time around, even if it was by some providers last time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the thing that's really important now is there are people who, even if a change was made to tax-free cash, are unlikely to be affected based on the amounts that are in their pension, but who might take action now, thinking that may change and could live to regret that. If they're 55.
Price, right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, somebody's 55 and they take their tax-free cash sum out, but they're still paying into a pension. That money then sits in a bank account rather than being invested. And the entitlement they could have had later in life when they come to retire might be much higher.
Mm.
So that's real detriment. And that's a real, you know, quite a big problem.
How much of that is an issue with people not having the right advice and sort of doing things off their own back? Yeah.
Well, advice is crucial. And, you know, I speak to many advisors and, you know, I always tell them, I don't know the answer to what will happen here, but it's helpful to think about how it might happen and what might what changes might be made and how they might be delivered and executed, and what kind of transitions and protections might be in place. And you know, once you talk through all of that, I think most advisors would tell me they're not advising clients to simply act on speculation. Maybe different if you're, you know, a month away from taking your tax-free cash. If you're going to do it in December and you bring it forward to November, that's not going to materially change your plans. You've nothing really to regret. But if you're bringing it forward by years, that is materially changing your plans. And I think most advisors would suggest not to act on this speculation, as some did last time. No advisors, you know, just like me, will know the answer to what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you have to work on the basis of what you know, rather than what you speculate.
Yeah, urge caution would perhaps be the advisor's message.
Yeah.
One thing, I suppose, the government and the FCA are pinning a lot of hopes on is targeted support. Your general assessment of that, due to be introduced next April. I mean, is that the magic bullet for lots of people?
Well, I mean, it'd be nice to think it's the magic bullet. Experience shows there is no magic bullet for any of these issues when it comes to getting people to take guidance and advice. I mean, to me, it certainly sits in squarely in the right place, which to me is somewhere between guidance that's already available and advice which is enormously valuable. And most people would hopefully seek out in later life, when they have greater funds and more wealth to worry about, more tax complications to think about. And advice is enormously valuable at that stage. But there's a gap in between. And targeted support is intended to be, I mean, to my mind, it's an enhanced form of guidance. There's a technical definition that it sits within the world of advice, but it's certainly not trying to displace advice.
Well, advisors and providers will hope that that's not the case, will they? Because they could be liable for quite a lot of issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important that we get it right. There needs to be the right balance between how much data we obtain, what we can say to people, what liability that carries, and how it's distinguished from paid for professional advice, which will always be the gold standard.
How do you think that's going to be done by firms, that distinction? Do you think it's going to be in big red letters above the...
Well, there's something about disclosing to people the limitations of what targeted support can do. But I think, moreover, it will be restricted by the amount of data that we're able to obtain and keep it to that. If you start straying into sort of, you know, asking additional, you know, incrementally adding more questions and getting into more technical and difficult areas, that's where I think it starts to move from its original intention. And I don't think we should do that. We should keep it where it is, because quite quickly you get into the complex realms of advice, which is so much more valuable, but clearly at a cost, really. So
yeah, and a cost to the client and the firm as well. A lot there that we've spoken about. I mean, can I ask you, Jamie, if you were to give a prediction where the industry, financial services, pension industry might be in five years' time at the end of this parliamentary term?
Well, I'm an optimist, and I do think there is a lot of merit in what is proposed under the Pension Schemes Bill. It is the culmination of a number of things. I've said for years that, you know, what we don't want is a collection of pet projects that change direction with every minister. What we want is a coherent strategy and plan that we can all get behind. And we've been given that. Now, there may be elements of it that people don't like or do like, but we've been given a pretty clear plan with a timeline. And, you know, it's sort of looks at the dependencies and the sequencing of all of those different things. It centres around a theme of having fewer, larger providers that are offering, you know, value for money and sweeping up small pots and consolidating as a market. So that's pretty clear. Again, whether one likes it or not, it's clear, and that's helpful, and it stretches over a longer period. And then, of course, we've got the Pensions Commission, which arguably then looks at the decades that follow. And you couldn't ask for more long-term thinking in pensions, which is what we've been crying out for a long time.
Yeah, and that's due to report back in 2027. I mean, is there a danger, though, that the government don't take on the recommendations of the Pensions Commission because it's sort of independent of the departments, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a danger. And we clearly don't know where we'll be in 2027, and whatever is recommended probably goes well beyond 2030.
Yeah.
You know, who knows who will be in charge and what the economic position will be, what the sentiment of employers and employees towards saving will be. We don't know any of that. But We'd certainly be in a better place to have a plan that we can refer to rather than sort of scratching our heads when we get there.
Yeah. And but I mean, perhaps a clear indication of how important it is in the government's plans, Torsten Bell is on Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves' team for the budget. What was your reaction to that? Do you think there's anything?
Well, makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, pensions isn't just the private sector and the sort of 50 billion cost of tax relief and, you know, all that goes along with that. There'll be another pensions flip chart that covers the state pension costs and, you know, the way in which it's interwoven into benefits and so on. You've got local government pension schemes and so on.
Yeah.
So it's a really big and broad subject and will occupy quite a bit of space on this imaginary wall that I've created. So therefore, you've got somebody in Torsten Bell who not only has experience in this field prior to his political career, but also has a foot both as pensions minister in the Department for Work and Pensions, but also in Treasury. So it makes a lot of sense that he would be involved. I'd be surprised if he hadn't been.
Yeah, and he's sort of been leading the government's charge on more investment in private markets from providers.
Indeed.
Certainly. Jamie Jenkins, thank you very much for joining me.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.